This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. One of the most beloved comedians on Saturday Night Live was Gilda Radner. Her hilarious send-up of Barbara Walters, Baba Wawa, and her zany, lovable Emily Latella and Roseanne Rosanna Dana were high points of the show's early years.
So what does she do? She opens her perfect little purse and takes out a perfect little Kleenex and draws her perfect little fez and then throws a perfect little Kleenex into a perfect little Tiffany trash can. But what this cutie didn't know was when she wiped off her nose, she didn't push back in this one little perfect little nose hair. It just stuck out there. And it was long, and it was black, and it was perfect, and I thought I was gonna die. Just between you and me, Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana, I felt like yanking down two more hairs, braiding them, and putting a bead at the end.
Radner's collaborator on the set was writer Alan Zweibel, who, like her, was in his early 20s and just getting started in his career. The two of them hit it off right from the start, and their friendship remained strong until Radner's death from cancer. A couple of years ago, Zweibel wrote a book about their relationship called Bunny Bunny, which he has adapted into a play. It had its premiere last week in Philadelphia. Playing the part of Alan Zweibel is actor Bruno Kirby. Kirby has appeared in Spinal Tap, Tin Man, Godfather 2, The Freshman, and Barry Levinson's new film, Sleepers. Zweibel has received numerous awards for his television work. He created and produced It's Gary Shandling Show, among others. Zweibel told me about the origin of the title of his play.
Bunny Bunny was a, sort of a superstition that Gilda had. I since found out that other people have the same sort of superstition. She felt that if the first words out of her mouth on the first day of the month were Bunny Bunny, it would bring like good luck for that month and it would ward off bad things. And as I started to promote the book, I found out that some people say rabbit, rabbit.
Right, I've heard that.
I've heard rabbit, rabbit.
Because where I grew up, we said rabbi, rabbi. This is a Long Island thing. So I didn't know about this, but that's where I first heard it. And that's what, it's sort of thematic in the book and in the play. It comes up a couple of times.
How has writing this book, now turning it into a play, how has that helped you heal the pain that you felt from her death?
You know, I can't tell. I think it has. You know, I wrote this just at the behest of my wife, who said about 3 or 4 years after Gilda died, you know, you're going to have to deal with it sooner or later. You know, you're going to have to get some sort of closure. And so I said, all right, and I wrote it. And I was working on a movie at the time, so it was like a journal. In the morning, late at night, when everybody was sleeping. And I just wrote it in dialogue, because it was just for me. I just wanted to relive the relationship one more time. And I didn't want, like, paragraphs and punctuation to impose itself. And then at the end of 9 months or so, I figured, okay, we got closure. Okay, good. Well, then I ultimately published it. Okay, closure. Okay, now it's a play. I keep on closing and opening and closing. So I honestly don't know the answer to that question. Last night at the premiere, people were crying in the second act, and it was a really nice night, and I just walked into the lobby sort of spent, and I'm going, why do I do this to myself? You know, I'm thrilled that people like it, but on a personal level, I'm going, wow, I can't take this roller coaster. Yeah, this is, it's really draining.
Well, is it draining for you, Bruno Kirby, to play the part of Alan in this play, and also to relive some of the intimacy of that relationship?
No, I wouldn't describe it as an actor. I find it just the opposite. It's invigorating. In this play, there's so much that happens to the character of Alan Zweibel in terms of his relationship with her. I mean, you get to see these two people genuinely fall in love and try and work through that and accept it and try and define this relationship, what it's going to be, what it's not going to be. And you see how much she must really mean to him, because he does whatever he can to keep her in his life. To me, this is a love story at a very high level, because it's a love story about two people who never really have sex. That's very unusual for a man and a woman to keep a relationship alive when it's not sexual in any way. And it's a tremendous piece of work.
As you look back at your relationship with Gilda Radner, are you sorry you weren't sexual, intimate, or are you glad that you resisted?
I'm not the one who resisted.
Yeah. I mean, I
think I was the one who, in answer to your
question. But you respected her resistance.
You Yeah, kicking and screaming. Yeah, that was a form of respect. I was, you know something, if where I was at that time in my life, if it had been anything more than just a friendship, I don't think we'd be here talking about this right now.
Well, that's what I mean.
So the answer is yeah. I mean, I'm real happily married. I got the three best kids on the planet, and I still have this other thing in my life that I look at this play and I go, how lucky was I? I was living this fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I would be able to say that had it been any other way. And she was the architect of that.
Well, Alan Zweibel, take us back to that time if you can. We can relive some of the early days of Saturday Night Live. Tell us, first of all, how you met Gilda Radner.
Oh, it was the first day ever. It was in Lorne Michaels' office. There was this big meeting. All the writers and the actors met in Lorne's office, and I was 24, and Lorne had found me. I was working a delicatessen in Queens, New York, and you name it, I sliced it for about 2 years, okay? And I was writing jokes for all these stand-up comedians in the Borscht Belt for $7 a joke, then $10 a joke, and so to supplement this wonderful living, I was working in a deli, and
But for people like Rodney Dangerfield.
Rodney Dangerfield and Freddie Prinze, mm-hmm. but that was the high end already. I mean, I'd done tons of singers, and every Mickey, Morty, Lee, and Dickey that ever lived and played the Catskill Mountains, I wrote for. And they were twice my age, and the sensibilities were different. So what I did was I took the jokes they wouldn't buy, and I made a stand-up comedy act for myself. And I went to the city every night to catch a rising star in the improvisation, got on stage, delivered my jokes with the hope that somebody would come in and like my writing and give me a job. Well, one night around 2 o'clock in the morning, I get off the stage and I'm sweating like a pig. I had the hardest time making these six drunks from Des Moines laugh. And I go to the bar and I'm waiting for my ride home. Billy Crystal was starting out at that time also. And he lived three towns away from my parents. And he was married and had children because he's more mature than me. And I was waiting for Billy to get off the stage so we can drive home. And I'm sitting at the bar and this guy comes in. He sits next to me and he looks at me. And after a minute or so, he says, you know, you're the worst comedian I've ever seen in my life. And I went, yeah, I know. It's really pathetic. He said, but the material's not bad. Did you write it? And I said, yeah. He said, would I be able to see more of it? I said, you bet. And I didn't even ask who it was because I would have shown it to like a gardener at that point. It was Lorne Michaels, okay? And he gave me a job on his brand new show.
Wow. And obviously, as a writer, not as just a writer. One of the performers.
No. But what happened was 2 months later, we started the show, and it was the first writers' meeting and cast meeting. Everybody got to know each other. And I walked into Lorne's office, and I look around, and I see Belushi, and I see Aykroyd, and Chevy, and I'm going, oh, my God, I'm a fraud. They're going to discover me.
And you're 24 years old.
24, and there's no way in hell that I can compete with these people. So I looked around the room, and in a corner of the room, there was this big potted plant that I very maturely went behind and squatted down and hid so I wouldn't have to be called on and embarrass myself.
You mean that, really? Literally?
Literally squatted behind a plant because I didn't feel like I can sell my sketches, you know, because you had to perform them in a way, and there was a social aspect to it. So I'm squatting behind this plant, and about 10 minutes into the meeting, I hear this voice coming from the other side saying, can you help me be a parakeet? And I went, what? And I hear the voice say, this girl's voice say, yeah, I think it'd be really funny if I sort of squished up my face, stood on a perch and acted like a parakeet, but I need a writer to help me figure out what the parakeet would say. And she says, can you help me figure it out? I go, yeah. I didn't have any idea what she was talking about. And I parted the leaves and I looked through and it was Gilda. And we got to talking and it ended up that she was just as scared as I was. So she came around the plant and we squatted down there and we spent the rest of the meeting there and we started becoming friends.
Let me turn to you, Bruno Kirby, because you've been in some wonderful films. You're an actor who I've really enjoyed in just about everything that you have done. How did you get your start in acting?
Well, my dad is a wonderful actor. His name is Bruce Kirby, and we're incredibly close. I was born on his birthday. And his attitude when I came along was, well, here's my best friend. That was his attitude. He literally took me every place he went. He took me to Lee Strasberg's class. He sat me down next to people like Marilyn Monroe and told me to be very quiet.
How old were you at the time?
Oh, I was just a little kid. I don't even know how old I was. He took me immediately. And he would also do this thing, my dad, where he would work as a maitre d'. And he would come home at night, sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning. It didn't matter even if it was a school night. And his nickname for me was Pal. And he'd say, hey, Pal, are you awake? And I'd say, yeah. And he'd pick me up and he would take me to 42nd Street. And we would sit there when 42nd Street was much different than it is now, and we would watch Fellini films together at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we would just hang out together. And I love him to this day. He's my best friend, and I think I'm an actor because of him. When he would go out after class with his actor friends and sit around and do jokes and shtick for each other, and I would be part of it, that's still to this day my favorite part of acting, is the camaraderie, the group effort. I really appreciate that a lot.
We'll hear more from writer Alan Zweibel and actor Bruno Kirby after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to writer Alan Zweibel and actor Bruno Kirby.
Well, let me turn to you, Alan Zweibel. When did you begin writing jokes? I mean, were you one of the funny kids in class, the class clown, the kid that got taken to the principal's office for disrupting?
No, I was a big jock. And I was, you know, when the old Dick Van Dyke show came on television, I went, wow, that's sort of cool. You know, you just sit around with some other people, you just crack jokes all day, and you go home to Laura Petri, and you got this nice house in New Rochelle. What's wrong there? You know, that could be good. So I just try to figure out how to do that. And unfortunately, there was no prescription as to how you get to be that. I don't know two writers who got to wherever they are the same way. It was just, it's not like, you know, you want to be a doctor. Well, there's certain rules that you do, and you persevere, and it's real hard, a lot of studying. But there's a course you take, and eventually you're a doctor. With this, I just didn't know what to do. So I went to school at the University of Buffalo up in New York. And I don't know if you know anything about Buffalo, but it gets cold there over the winter.
Yeah, I've heard. Lots of snow, right?
And what I would do is I started writing jokes that I sent into to Johnny Carson when he had a show in New York, and Dick Cavett and Mad Magazine, just to test the waters and just unsolicited stuff. And they started using some of my stuff. And I didn't care that I wasn't getting paid. It was just encouragement, because you don't know if you have anything to offer. You know, it's one thing to be sort of funny at a party, but, you know, can you manufacture a situation and then be funny within that? And when I left college, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I'd never wanted to really be a lawyer, but I figured I don't know how to do this writing thing. So I figured I'd go to law school, get a degree and put it in a drawer, and then go out and, you know, but at least have like a net to work with. The law schools had something else in mind for me. I took the law boards, which is like the SATs. You know, if you can just write your name.
Right, you get 100 points or
something.
Well,
200. You get everything right, you get 800. Right. So 200 for writing your name. I got a 310, which was like vegetable mentality. It was pathetic. It was really – so basically they said, no. You be a writer. And so when I left college, I started hanging out at the clubs and writing jokes and writing for those guys up in the Catskills.
Well, you mentioned the Dick Van Dyke Show, and in your play you say, when I was a little boy, I used to watch the old Dick Van Dyke Show and say that that's the kind of life I want to have, you know, to be a TV comedy writer, have a wife, a family, a home. That was my goal. And then Gilda says back to you, and you're achieving it. Do you feel like you have?
Yeah, I'm real lucky. I mean, I got this great wife, and I got three kids, and, you know, the weird part is that I was doing a Steve Martin special a long time ago, and we were rehearsing in NOLA Studios in New York. I think it was like 57th and Broadway at the time. And we were like rehearsing in Studio A. And in Studio B, Dick Van Dyke was rehearsing for some special he was doing. Mm-hmm. And I heard he was there. And this is like 81-ish. And we had just had our first child, Adam. And I go, wow, I just want to thank the guy for his inspiration. So rehearsal ended one day, I waited, and he came out, and I took an elevator down with him, and I said, Mr. Van Dyke, I just wanted to thank you for being such an inspiration to me. My name is Alan, and I grew up watching your show, and I said I wanted to be a comedy writer and marry someone like Laura. And I said, well, you know, I have this real pretty wife. I'm a comedy writer. We're thinking maybe buying a house, and we just had our first kid, just like you and, you know, Mary Tyler Moore had Richie, and you know, it's like working, and I just want to thank you for giving me this thing to shoot for. And he put his arm around me, and he said to Alan, just a word of caution, he said, after 5 years, the Van Dyke Show was canceled, and I became an alcoholic. And I went, ah, I see, okay. That was a rough elevator ride. So, yeah, I'm pretty lucky. Very lucky that I achieved
it. It must be, though, interesting to write for different kinds of people, from Rodney Dangerfield to Gilda Radner to Johnny Carson to Gary Shandling, because everybody has their different body language, their different styles, different nuances. I mean, how much does a comedy writer have to take all of that into account?
That's a great question. What I used to do is, you're absolutely right, because what was funny for Jack Benny, it came out of character and wouldn't necessarily be funny for Johnny Carson or for Joan Rivers. What I used to do as a way of just training myself, and I made this up. No one taught me to do this. Mm-hmm. It just made sense to me. I'd sit down on a Monday morning and I'd say, okay, this week we're going to – the subject is iced coffee, okay? Monday I would write a monologue as if Woody Allen was delivering it about iced coffee. Tuesday would be as if Phyllis Diller was doing it, and Wednesday, Jack Benny. And by the end of the week, I had five different monologues about iced coffee. Each had a different syntax, a different rhythm to it, and try to tune my ear to different people. And then what that does for you ultimately is it allows you to write a script where everybody doesn't sound the same. So the training that one gets when they're writing for different voices is invaluable. The hardest jokes to write, those are the easy jokes to write, because you write for Rodney Dangerfield and he's got this I don't get no respect thing. It's really easy for me to write. You know, even as an infant, I didn't get any respect. When I was born, my mother wouldn't breastfeed me. She said she liked me as a friend. Okay, that's an easy thing to do. That's easy because, you know, you just put that in his mouth. It's the jokes that have to stand by themselves, you know, no matter, and get a laugh no matter who. What voice delivers them, those are the hardest ones to do.
Tell us about working with Gary Shandling. And I have to say, I love the Larry Sanders Show. I thought that was about the best thing on television for some time. And he does have a gentle, self-deprecating kind of humor that's so inviting.
Gary, like I mentioned before, is just man, he's just totally exposed. He's raw. And I respond to just that honesty there. He is, I was lucky because what I had, I thought with Gilda, I had with Gary. Gilda had brought like the woman out in me, and I brought out the guy in her. Gary and I, we took turns, you know, because, you know, both guys, and you'll be the woman today, I'll be the woman tomorrow, you know. But it was it's rare when two people meet and all of a sudden it's just like when you fall in love with somebody. How do you define it? There's just something that's there. Gary is I think, in my estimation, the smartest guy out there. I think he's an insanely great writer. I think that he's got a better sense of himself than anyone that I know. And if I wanted to be really lofty about it, I would think that he is one of the few guys out there now, in my estimate, I don't know everybody, so I'm just talking about the people that I know, okay?
Right.
That can get a laugh based on nuance because you know the character. Jack Benny, the longest recorded laugh in radio history was Jack Benny with silence. It was when a robber came up to him and put a gun in his back and said, "Your money or your life." And Jack Benny was just silence, and people knew that he was cheap. That was his trademark. And the longer he didn't talk, the louder and louder the audience laughed. And if you listen to the tapes, they laugh for about 40 seconds, and then the robber goes, "Well," and Jack Benny goes, "I'm thinking, okay?" And then they laugh. And Gary has created a character, a persona for himself, where he doesn't have to do jokes. There are nuances and they're just subtleties that you know the character that well that it's funny to you. And he's great.
Can you write for someone you don't like?
Wow, what a great question. I tried that a couple of times. I've had a couple of series that didn't work, and I found myself that I couldn't do it. I can't even imagine trying to get into that head and that whole psyche where you would be that kind of person, and I think that's masterful. I know that on the few occasions where I made wrong choices and took wrong series or created something but cast it improperly, it's that thing where you're trying to take somebody who is what they are and make them into something that you want them to be. And when you see that that doesn't work, you go, all right, let me go the other way. Let me feed what they are and go, you know something? I don't know how to get into that, you know? And that might be a deficiency I have as a writer, you know. But at the same time, I find that very difficult because it doesn't come off honest.
Yeah, what do you think about that, what he just said?
Just to make it into an acting question, can you play somebody who you don't like?
Right.
Well, in certain cases, I played a pedophile in Basketball Diaries and this abusive guy in Sleepers. And those were the first times that I've played some people who, you know, in Sleepers I could find some things about that guy because I knew how he had to be abused to end up that way. And the pedophile, there's something about someone who abuses children that is really hard. That was the first time I ever played somebody that, even though I could understand them, I couldn't like them. So it makes it, you know, very difficult. So I imagine just writing for someone who you didn't like. Because, you know, I was around the show that they did together. I worked on it. I played Gary's manager on the Gary Shandling show. And I watched them work together. And it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, we'd be shooting that show and they could go off in a corner with an audience
there.
And just stop things for 5 minutes and come up with a whole new point of view on a scene together. It was like a magical thing. And so I would imagine to take that energy and try and give it to someone who you didn't really care for as a person would be very difficult, I would imagine.
That's Bruno Kirby and Alan Zweibel. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.